The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
KNUS Denver,
a Salem Media Group station.
He is an Army veteran.
Duty, honor, country.
And district attorney for Colorado's 18th Judicial District.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Most important, he's a father and a proud American.
Americans love a winner.
He is George Brockler. And this is The George Show on News Talk 710 KNUS.
I'm brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
Everything that guy just says, bull.
Well, that may be true, but that's not true for our next guest. George Brockler back here on The George Show on 710 KNUS. Happy. First time ever, I think, that I've had the opportunity to speak to her when she can speak back. Of course, I've talked to her on the radio as she says things, and I say things like, right on, or yeah, I believe it, and keep going. But this will be the first time that I actually can hear her respond to my comments. Michelle Malkin on 710 KNUS. Ma'am, thank you so much for being on.
Oh, kind sir, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Especially on a Saturday morning at 7 a.m. I presume you work all the time, but I'm thinking, why are you already out of bed?
Well, I work hard and I play hard. And, you know, a lot of locals here in the Springs know that I'm a big pickleball addict. Oh. I'm also a Manitou Incline addict. And the best time to do these things is early in the morning before it gets hot.
Thank you for saying the Manitou Springs Incline, because my wife and I had been looking at that. There is a smaller version. The mini incline is in Castle Rock, and it's cool.
Yes, That's a good warm-up.
That's right. Have they reopened Manitou Springs?
Well, there's a debate on Tuesday in the city council on the conditions under which it will be open. But, you know, for the diehards, the hardcore folks, they've been there. They're not going to let COVID
stop
them from being healthy.
So is it fair to say
it's
officially not open?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Okay, great. I'll have to go. Well, you know, and that's not my jurisdiction. That's a guy named Dan May. He can do whatever he wants, you know.
Right.
So anyway, thanks for being on. And I have listened to you now over the last couple weeks really describe the impact of the chaos of the protests up in Denver. And we'll get to that. But, you know, as someone who's been listening to you and reading you, I mean, my God, you've been doing the syndicated column now for, what, 21 years now?
Yeah.
All of that stuff. Some of the stuff that you get are these little glimpses of you, like, oh, and I do the Manitou Springs Incline, and I'm big at pickleball. As we go, do you mind if I just step back a little bit and say, tell us how you got here? I mean, how do you get to the place where you're a 2+ million Twitter follower, little brown woman with a big mouth fighting the conservative cause, sometimes uphill with a big headwind? How do you get there from where you started?
Oh, great question, and it is nice to sort of look at these things from 30,000 feet. I attribute it mostly to my parents, but above all to God. And there's a favorite scripture that the late Mike Adams always referenced when he was teaching his kids and students. By the way, he was a teacher for 12 years at Summit Ministries in Manitou Springs. Hmm. It's James 4:17, and it says, "Therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin." And that's sort of, it's written in my DNA, it's written in my soul, that to sit on the sidelines and not do something when you see evil is evil itself. And that was ingrained in me from the time I was old enough to comprehend. And for me, the gifts that God gave me were gifts of verbal ability and written skill. And the irony of all of this, and of course God works in mysterious ways, George, is that growing up, I was an incredible introvert. I failed my speech classes. I talk about this on campus when I speak to campus groups and college groups, and particularly young women, many of whom, you know, sort of had my same kind of outlook when I was younger, you know, that it was better not to be involved in conflict and, you know, not to stand out from the crowd. But I was compelled, particularly in college. I went to a far-left campus, and that's redundant, but really one of the craziest ones. We called it Berserkly of the Midwest, a small liberal arts college called Oberlin College.
Oh, yeah, I know Oberlin. Yeah.
Yes, a breeding ground for all of the worst excesses of progressive intolerance. And their main claim to fame is that they really were the progenitors of this idea of a quote-unquote safe space.
Wow.
That's their claim to fame. But it was, of course, the most unsafe space for anyone who strayed from cultural Marxism and liberal orthodoxy. And I had to choose a path. Was I going to keep quiet about it? You know, if I didn't speak for myself, you know, there was a lot of other people who presumed to know what I should think and how I should live my life.
Before you got to Oberlin, and the only reason I know them is I think they're a D3 school, Division III sports school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an average football player in high school, but average enough that somebody from that coaching staff reached out and said, "Hey, would you ever be interested?" And I said, "Yeah, do you guys offer scholarships?" And they said, "No." And I said, "No, I can't do it."
Interesting.
So I took my ROTC scholarship up to CU Boulder, also an incredibly conservative campus, as you know. Very, very conservative.
Renowned.
Where did you do grammar school and middle school and high school and all that, leading up to Oberlin?
Yes. So I grew up in South Jersey. I was born in Philadelphia. I went to a tiny, tiny public school up through eighth grade, and then a traditional Catholic high school, Holy Spirit High School in Absecon, New Jersey. And everything I needed to know to be equipped, you know, to sort of battle in the public square over the issues that I've covered for the last 30 years, I really sort of took on the armor of that in high school, and I had many mentors. Father Battisti, the principal of the high school, was just a, you know, incredible spiritual mentor. And then, you know, I went off to college in Ohio, and then after that, really cut my teeth in daily newspaper journalism in these coastal bubbles
interesting.
In Los Angeles and Seattle before I did my tour of duty in D.C. in the swamp for over 10 years.
Now, listen, I'm a parent of four, and so I'm interested in this from your perspective. What did mom and dad do that you think laid the groundwork for you to have this coming out of the cocoon moment in terms of taking all those values and then starting to say, you know what, I'm not just going to hold them on the inside, I'm going to put them outside too?
Wow, this is an amazing session. They practiced what they preached. I think that's the main thing. You know, it wasn't merely that they told us that hard work was its own reward, and that that we needed to honor our God, and that you know, we couldn't take for granted all of the blessings that we had here. It's well known, my own personal story. I've lived my life, you know, very transparently out in the open.
You have, that's true.
For these last three decades, my parents were immigrants, legal immigrants from the Philippines. My dad was a neonatologist in Atlantic City. My mom was a public school teacher for 30 years. They instilled these values and they lived their values. And particularly my dad, who's just my hero, was, you know, a quiet man. You know, he's not a showboat. And he was not some sort of, you know, political partisan in any way. But he always stood up for what was right, and he never feared speaking out for the truth.
Yeah, the fearlessness is a big deal. Are either of your parents still with us, Michelle?
They are both. God, now, thank God.
How often do they ever reach out to you and say something like, not either like Adam, Michelle, like great, or do they? Does mom ever call up and go, hey, tone it down or something like that?
You know, that is so funny that you ask that, because I do have these conversations a lot with my father. You know, he's become, you know, incredibly reflective. He's almost 80 now.
Wow.
And, you know, he does counsel me. He gives me such wise counsel. And so we do have these arguments because, you know, we have to speak boldly, but we have to speak with grace. And it's always a balancing act. And, And he sent me a video from Ravi Zacharias. It was released posthumously. He died a couple of years ago from cancer and had given a talk right before the November 16 election about how church leaders should communicate in a, you know, a very combative secular word. And, it, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with him, but he always spoke with such calmness.
Yeah.
I'm learning that. Maybe by the time I'm 80, I'll get there, George.
We're talking with Michelle Malkin. Let me follow up with that, if you don't mind. And that is, do they ever express to you, especially in light of what I've heard you talk about since the protest, do they ever express to you their own concerns for you? And not so much the substance of what you're saying, but the response to it. Like, you know, I hate to go Taylor Swift with you, but haters gonna hate, right?
Yeah.
And there's a ton of it that comes for conservatives, especially ones like you that stand out on the tip of the spear. Do they ever express to you those kinds of concerns, or are those things they keep to themselves and just continue to support you?
They support me and they worry about me. And of course, I feel the same way about my own kids, who always roll my eyes, their eyes, every time they leave the house, and I say, be careful, be safe. And that's my parents. They do worry all the time, and both of them have, you know, lived through a lot in their lives, and I'm sure, like a lot of your listeners and you, feel that these times are more tense, more escalated, more divisive than we've ever seen. And yeah, they watched the live stream and were alarmed, and I've said this publicly, George, they stage an intervention basically with my husband and our best friends to get me to promise to at least dial back just a little bit and take a little breather from all of this, which of course is hard for me to do. Like I said, it's sort of ingrained in my DNA not to sit on the sidelines.
Now, look, in light of that, and you and I, mercifully, are not old enough to remember the tough 60s, but
yes.
When you look back at footage and read about the history and all that, do you feel like that where we're at today is either as bad or worse than what was going on in the 60s, or are we on the precipice of something worse?
Well, I mean, you put it so well when you described in your op-ed in the Denver Post several weeks ago, just that the chaos and the anarchy that we are living through now. And yeah, I wasn't around in the 60s, but I cut my teeth in newspaper journalism in the aftermath of the L.A. riots.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you can draw a bright line from the 60s to the riots of 1992 through the incredibly bloody turmoil under the Obama years. People forget that there was a declared explicit war on police officers and the birth of Black Lives Matter, which again is really just an extension of Weather Underground, Black Liberation Army, all of these domestic terrorist groups that have been allowed to fester. To me, it's a perfect storm now, because you've got the tyranny that's been metastasizing in, under the age of COVID, combined with this riot atmosphere that is coddled by, you know well, George,
yep,
right?
Yep,
all of
yep.
the Soros-subsidized district attorneys, police chiefs, sheriffs out there who are sworn to protect and sworn to provide equal protection under the laws, but are doing everything they can to sabotage it and destroy our country.
Well, I think we're going to see that again in these elections in a way that we haven't. And you probably remember this, but just 4 years ago, a great DA out in Jeffco, Pete Weir, had like $1.1 million dropped on top of him by Soros to knock him out of the office. He was one of two DAs nationally that survived the Soros money tsunami. And I think it's going to show up again here probably about, October. For
yes.
A lot of these metro area races.
Yes, yes, no question about it. And I mean, all I can do at this point is give credit, you know, to the incredible umbrella organization that extends from the Open Society Foundation, which is the main conduit of Soros money, and to this entire constellation of nonprofit groups, non-governmental organizations that are all in lockstep with each other. And, you know, to call it a conspiracy really, I think, doesn't adequately explain what's going on here, because there doesn't need to be, you know, direct orders from the top. They're all all simpatico. If only the right had as much, you know, discipline unanimity of spirit and focus in these matters, maybe we wouldn't be as much trouble as we're in now.
It does feel like the other side seems to have a commitment to a longer term goal that we just can't seem to get there. And maybe it's because we're all, you know, we believe in the individual and we're big liberty lovers, and they're into something far more collective and larger, and they're just this slow moving blob that's going to roll through town and take over the movie theater and everything. But let me ask you this. How much of what we're seeing now, in your opinion — I've tried to think about this a lot since March — how much of what we're seeing in terms of the, and I'm going to use air quotes for the word success, the success of these rioters and the more aggressive, violent protesters, whatnot, is a product of this black swan-like event where we have a pandemic that has freed up, good or bad, a whole bunch of people to not have to go into the office. We're providing a huge subsidy for people from the government to free them up to do God knows what. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's work around the house. Maybe it's parent. Maybe it's look for another job. It just feels like, had these exact same events taken place in Minneapolis, as horrible as they were, and the other parts of the country, yes, there would have been protests. Yes, but nothing like this. It feels like this is so unusual in terms of its timing and the reason for it.
Yeah, that, again, it's a great question, and there's definitely a multiplier effect of a fuel on a pre-existing fire. You know, and every grassroots conservative activist out there, anyone who's, you know, even half paying attention to social media or the news cycle, knows that it's not just Soros. I mean, there's a Tides Foundation, MacArthur Foundation, Ford Foundation that keeps so many of these shock troops on the left employed full time. And then, of course, many of them are tax subsidized public employee. Public employees. They've got a lot of discretionary time, but you add to that, like you said, George, all of these people who are out of work now, many of them with, you know, I'm going to say many of them have justified grievances. It's ridiculous, the overreaction you know, the lockdown mania that we have that is depriving people who were gainfully employed before. But there are other factors too here, and you know, my greatest concern, of course, has always been twofold, and one is the effect of mass migration on this country. You know, not just about the people who are bringing in without regard to the kind of skills or allegiance that they should have, but also the fact that it takes away focus from the native-born population and the systemic problems, the economic issues that they're facing. But the other issue, of course, is education, and it's very alarming that we're raising generations of young people who are incapable of practicing critical thinking skills and discerning the truth from falsehood.
Yeah, it's not just first off, that last part really resonates with me. I mean, the immigration issue has been one that has been building for a while, but it feels like we lost the battle over education a couple few decades ago, and now we're starting to see what that looks like, right? And you have generations now, two generations of now adults that went through a process where they weren't instilled with the same values that I remember getting when I was in school. They weren't taught about even civics in terms of how government works and its role in society. And now we're at a place where the idea of free stuff and who owes who what and I'm a victim, that this couldn't have existed in the 80s. It could not have existed. And now here it is everywhere. I see it with my own kids and some of the stuff they bring home from school.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, the right, I think, has justly focused on higher education, but I think they've done it to the detriment of leaving the left to hijack K through 12. And by the time you get to college, it's too late. And school choice, as much as I had been an advocate of it, as well as charter schools — my kids went to charter schools in Colorado Springs — it is a very small piece of the puzzle. And when you yield K through 12 public education. Look, the vast majority of kids go to public schools. And if you're not going to do something about it and simply sort of absent yourself away and leave it to other people, well, guess what? Nature abhors a vacuum, and so does public education.
Absolutely. Look, as we head into November, and it seems like every 4 years we say the same thing, most important of election of our lives, most important election of our lives. And I feel the exact same way about this one in November. When you look at the polling and you look at the issues that are developing around the country and the COVID and the this and the that and the protests and the riots, and I'm going to admit, 4 years ago, I didn't think the president was going to win. I thought we might hold on to the Senate. I didn't think he was. So I was shocked. So I'm on my heels a little bit on how do you even predict what could happen? But be a prognosticator for us. How do you see this playing out? And what should those conservatives do out there to try to help, I suppose, keep us moving in the right direction?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be a nail biter. And we've known for decades that the left cheats, and they cheat ruthlessly. And their explicit slogan and modus operandi is by any means necessary. And it's not enough for people of good faith on the right to say, oh, that's not fair, right? I mean, that's what we do. They act in untoward, horrible manners. Like, for example, the funeral of John Lewis. Oh, they're such terrible people. Yeah, and so what are you going to do to combat it and overcome it? We need to be tougher. And that was the lesson, too, as well, of the Back the Blue chaos in Denver. We have to be prepared. We have to be armed. And the last thing I'll say about heading into November is, look, you know, I voted for Donald Trump. I did so willingly, and I think that he's done a lot of good things. But you send somebody there who comes from outside of the establishment, and inevitably these swamp creatures infest his places of power. And that's what's happened. And so, you know, whether it's Donald Trump or somebody else in office, whoever it is, you know, the fact is that we have to start draining the swamps in our own backyards. And we have to pay it. We have to pay attention to local and state politics. We need more people like you in elected office.
I appreciate that,
George. And people need to start there. That is my prime recommendation for my fellow Coloradans.
Good stuff. Last question before I let you go. This is a parenting one again. If there was a book, not the Bible, another book that you remember exposing your kids to that you think was part of a difference maker for them in terms of how they thought about the world and thought about things, what is that if it sticks out in your mind?
Yes. Both of my kids read 1984 in middle school, and I couldn't think of a more relevant book right now than that one.
Or, well, that's a great one. Michelle Malkin, thank you for giving us some of your Saturday morning for this conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Same. Thank you, George. Take care.
Take care. You too. Hey, that was Michelle Malkin. First time ever having her on the show. That was great. I love to hear about the background stuff. I'm always interested as a parent as to how people became the adults that they became and what they do with their own children, especially in this day and age. And we're going to talk about some education stuff later on. But look, react to that interview, and what are your thoughts on that? 303-696-1971. We're going to cut away for a quick break, but we're going to return. I'm George Brockler. This is The George Show on 710 KNUS.
Now, back to The George Show with George Brockler on News Talk 710 KNUS.
Hey, we're back on The George Show on 710 KNUS. This is a transparent show where we show our mistakes, and I've got one coming up right now. I thought we had a super guest coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Instead, apparently, we'd scheduled for the 7 o'clock hour, and that's my fault that he's been hanging out listening to the great Michelle Malkin instead of coming on talking to us about a very important topic right now. Henry Sobenet, a super genius when it comes to all matters fiscal, including the state of Colorado, is on the VIP line with us. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Oh, good morning. It's my pleasure to be here. How are you?
I'm good. Please accept my apologies. I thought we had confirmed for a different time, but that's on me. You guys do a great job. So thank you for giving us any time that you have left.
I'm happy to be here. No worries at all.
Now, hey, you are a fellow at the Common Sense Institute, and they're fantastic. We've had on guests from them. I mean, from Kristen Strom to Dr. D, talking about education, talking about impact of the economy on women. But you were part of, with Ben Stein, I think, a study that was done that looks at something that every single Coloradan, doesn't matter where you are, metro, area, or rural, can appreciate, and that is the fact that our roads suck, and we got to do something about that. Now, you're a super genius in the fiscal world. You are in charge of, in some ways, the state's money through multiple administrations, and now you've taken a look with some other super smart people at how do we tackle this program. Tell us about what you concluded.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I appreciate it. So, yes, Terry J. Stevenson sponsored this fellowship for Ben Stein and I to take a look at transportation. And even in the midst of all the health crisis and the recession we're in, we found a way forward to kind of describe how we got here and some possible strategies for getting us out of it. And you set it up very well, sir. Our roads are in bad shape. And the main reason for it is that we've been relying on the per gallon gas tax since 1991 that hasn't changed at 22 cents a gallon for regular unleaded gas. And with fuel efficiency rising and with construction costs up, it's just not keeping up with maintaining our road system. Our competitor states around the country have figured this out. And in just the last 10 years, 31 states made big reforms to their transportation finance, but we're not on that list yet.
Is there a common thread through those 31 states' efforts to reform the way they fund transportation?
Well, it's awkward because the conversation gets political a little quickly because we have a little higher standard in Colorado. We need to go to a vote of the people.
Oh, Tabor.
And I think in the state, yeah, with Tabor. And the other states that have done this have been able to do it through their legislative process.
Now, having said that, those 31 states, when you're talking about increasing revenue through a new stream or one that exists, and they're not doing it through a gas tax, or are they raising the gas tax? Like, what's the are they doing a per mile sort of tax? How are they doing it?
Yes, it's a combination of either changing their gas tax to where there's a little bit of an indexing that goes on to keep up as fuel efficiency gets better, or they've just switched over to sales tax to augment their gas tax. Those have been the two most common combinations.
What was interesting about this study, too, was that it doesn't come out with this is the silver bullet fix, because I think you and I would agree there is no such thing, or we would have probably done it, right? There's just no one silver bullet fix. What do you guys recommend are the things that the state needs to look at to try to address this?
Well, thanks for noticing that. We didn't want to put out this is the thing you should do, because automatically that becomes the target. What we thought was important to, number one, explain that we have two problems. One, just the regular maintenance that's really boring to talk about, which is just pavement quality, potholes, and doesn't do a ton for what people are really sore about, which is congestion. So we broke the situation up into the maintenance gap and then expanding the system with better capacity and building a little bit for the future, but also making up for building that didn't happen along the way. So phase one, we think we have to stabilize and understand our situation. You know, people have not driven the same amount during the pandemic as before.
All right. True.
And there's some evidence that loss of driving and therefore revenue to fix roads is down permanently by some amount. And we really think you got to take stock of that. The second thing we need to do during the time between we get the recession over is take a scan of autonomous cars, electric vehicles, and make sure everybody is set up to pay their fair share for their use of the system.
By the way, I don't know that people appreciate that. Look, when you have an electric car, you ain't paying the gas tax, right? You're driving on the road, putting wear and tear on the road, but you're not paying that tax.
They do pay registration fee and they do pay their property tax on their car.
Yep.
But the gas tax is not part of the equation.
That's right.
And then as we get autonomous vehicles, we need a good structure to be ready to just everybody pays some kind of fair amount for their use of the system. Yeah. Then if people have a chance to look at the paper, Common Sense Institute, co.org, we've included the most recent prioritized list of what the next $3.2 billion of projects around the state would be. Our Colorado Transportation did a refresh of what they would pay for next, what they would build next if they had the money. And they did a statewide process, and we really felt that stakeholdering was good and no need to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of buy-in around the state around what's really needed next. And you can see on that list the major pain points on I-70. I-25 gets a look. There's rural. Colorado gets a big chunk, which, you know, sometimes they're not totally at the front of the line, but we need a network to get our food to our cities and other freight. So once we understand our new baseline, people can take a look at, do we want to fix maintenance or do we want to fix capacity or can we fix both? We've given kind of scenarios for all three options.
We're talking with Henry Sobenet, formerly of All Things Money for the state of Colorado, now a fellow with the Common Sense Institute on this transportation study. What do you guys recommend as where we need to go, even to the ballot, but on what issues for a source of revenue that will help fund the maintenance and then the rest of the phases?
Okay, great question. So we have identified five ways to pay for this, and they're pretty much the most popular things that are out there. So a sales tax increase, an income tax increase. The least popular one is probably registration fees on people's cars. A vehicle miles travel tax, which you alluded to a second ago, George, and then raising the gas tax. So for $300 million a year, if we did the gas tax, it'd be about 10 cents a gallon. But registration fee, it starts to kind of get your attention at almost $52 per car.
Now that we did that something with Faster a while ago. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yes, I do. In 2009, the legislature used the room that was under the Tabor limit at the time to raise registration fees by about $200 million a year. And we share some of that money with counties and cities. And that has added, a revenue stream to pay for bridges. It's how I-70 is getting fixed, for example. About 140 bridges, I think, have been fixed because of that money. And then a lot of pavement and other projects since then. But even with that bump, population growth plus construction costs in building roads, we're just not keeping up with where we were even 15 years ago, let alone 30 years ago.
Now, is this the kind of thing that has to be addressed through a referred measure from the legislature? Or is this something that, you know, you think that normal everyday Coloradans would get together and petition on, like trying to end the national popular vote?
Sure. There's a couple paths forward. We don't recommend just doing a fee straight up right now, mostly because that will crowd out money to pay back the general fund for the cuts they've made during the recession, and that's education and healthcare. So that's an option, but we don't recommend it. So basically, the implicit recommendation is to go to a vote, and that could happen. Either the legislature could refer one, or there could be a citizen initiative, just like a couple years ago. Voters have said no a few different times recently for things that would have given money to transportation. But we've also said, look, you need to keep trying. It's a higher standard in Colorado to get new money. That's what the voters have put into the Constitution. But a lot of other initiatives have taken two or three tries before they've been successful, including Tabor. So our advice is, look, this is pretty important. Transportation has never been higher in the public's mind if you look at recent opinion polling. But a sweet spot plan that kind of gets people what they want and seems affordable and accountable. We haven't found that yet, and our advice is to keep trying.
I will give you my own little super amateur, not as smart as you advice, and that is if you look around just the state initiatives that have complied with Tabor and attempted to raise taxes one way or another, they seem to historically get drubbed. I mean, I think we've only done it three times over the past however many years. But if you look at how the local governments have done it, how cities have done it, even Colorado Springs, they've been successful. And my own amateur opinion is when there's something on the ballot for the voters to vote on that is super specific and super targeted, like we want to raise this amount of money for this amount of time for this road or these roads or these projects or whatever it is, it seems like Coloradans are like, okay, I get it. I can trust that. Where they seem to have mistrust is when it seems far more loosey-goosey and broad and big picture-y, and it's, hey, it's money for education. And people are like, That seems too big, right? It's just not targeted enough. You've seen this from the inside. What are your thoughts on that?
I've seen it, I've lived it, and I've been on either side of those victories or defeats. I think your advice is good, and there's some ways to comply with what you're getting at, specificity and targeted and time-limited. If you read between the tea leaves of the options here, you could dedicate one of these revenue streams, you could target it to the 10-year list that CDOT has put together, and you could time-limit it. One thing that's really interesting to me is our gas tax is actually protected in the Constitution to be only used for construction, maintenance, and supervision of state highways. Hmm. And it's been that way since the 1930s. And so that money has always been where it's supposed to be. And even though it's not paying its way because of fuel efficiency, if you somehow found a reform to that gas tax, you would automatically connect into that constitutional protection. And maybe that could ensure the trust factor you're talking about.
When it comes to oversight of how these transportation dollars are spent, now, it used to be that, you know, like, I can't remember what the bill number is, one or something, there was always money that came out of the general fund for transportation. And then something happened, and you would know it, I wouldn't. But all of a sudden now, it's like we don't actually, the legislature doesn't get involved in appropriating any money, largely because of things like you said, which are the money goes directly to CDOT. And then CDOT makes decisions. And there's some oversight, but it's not the power of the purse. If I'm describing that incorrectly, correct me, please. But do you think there's a problem with that system?
You described it pretty well. And in fact, there's an appendix in our paper that shows the history of those general fund dollars. It was Senate Bill 1 for a long time, so you had the number
That's
right.
It, Senate Bill 1.
And then it was Senate Bill 228, and then that went away. And now we have this infusion from the hospital provider fee reform, but that's going to end in 2 years. So the general fund would go over to CDOT, and then the Transportation Commission, which is appointed by the governor, 11 members, they do a nonpartisan prioritization of how to spend the money, and that's been in place for I want to say over 100 years now. We have one of the most accountable and politics-free way of picking transportation projects in the country. So I feel like once the money gets into the system, we have a way of getting the projects prioritized and out the door in a way that a lot of stakeholders are comfortable with and know how it works and feel like it works okay. We don't have horse trading at the Capitol for vote for me and I'll get you your bridge and then we'll do your bridge. It's been depoliticized for a very long time.
Now, last question. I know you got to end up going, but can you just describe real quickly for listeners how bonding may impact some of what is recommended or not recommended as a potential source of revenue for us to get some of these projects going? And some folks on the right are very conflicted about bonding. They don't want to see any more debt taken on. What is your proposal or your thoughts on that?
Well, we've given a cash pay-as-you-go option, and we've given a bonding option for the project list. The arguments for bonding are two or three. One, the interest rates right now are really low. Incredibly low. And you'll probably make money by paying the interest because the inflation rate on the projects, if we wait to do them, is higher than the interest rate that you would pay on the bonds. The other reason for bonding, in addition to it's a little cheaper year after year, is, you know, you build a big capacity expansion, and this benefits the state for 20 to 30 years, except for the, you know, pavement maintenance along the way. And so you spread the payment of that over the users over a long period of time, and you don't make all the users of the system right now pay for it. So it's a way of sharing the cost over many people and many years to where current users aren't overly burdened for the amount they're going to benefit from it. And then lastly, I guess I would say, is when you do capacity expansion, you get the benefit earlier if you bond for the project. And then that economic multiplier happens sooner. The people and goods and services move through more quickly. You have better safety. So you get some immediate benefits more quickly. But I can see the arguments on the other side. But, you know, I think you can probably tell I see more pros than cons on bonding.
I can hear it. There's, frankly, bonding, makes a lot of sense to me in some areas. I get why some of the other fiscal hawks out there are opposed to it. But now you've done this study, you've done the education piece. Obviously, nothing's going to take place on the ballot in November that's going to touch this. We're too late in the cycle for that. What's the next step? Right. What happens next?
Well, yeah, you've had great questions. I appreciate them. And I can stay on a couple more if you need to. But what's next is what we hope the people interested in the subject learn or see it a different way. You know, the people deep in the subject already knew most of this. But I think for the journalists, the general policy people, legislative people, this distinction between just the maintenance gap and the capacity gap, it's pretty striking. And the longer we wait, the bigger the problem gets. So we feel like the pandemic has created a way to give some time for people to digest what to do next, see where these revenues land, see where our economy lands. There's still a decent upside chance for there to be a relatively quick recovery.
Oh my God, I hope you're right about that, Henry. I really do.
I think, you know, that can be out there. And as you start to see these treatments get a little bit better and the prospects for some vaccinations, we can know what our baseline is more quickly, take stock of how much of a maintenance gap do we want to take on.
And then start trying to figure out what that, that legislation
on the capacity,
or that.
Yeah, on the capacity list. So, you know, the other thing that we kind of allude to is if we try to make the perfect the enemy of the good, like it has to have the perfect amount of transit, it has to have the perfect amount of rural, and we lose sight of the, and forgive me,
we're out of time, but I want to say this. I want to have you back on at some point to talk about the transit piece, because the whole bike lane issue doesn't play as well in Ray, Colorado, as it does in Boulder and Denver. So, I mean, all of that stuff is a huge controversial issue, but we can talk about that later. Sir, once again, accept my apologies for not getting you on at 7, but thank you. This was a great conversation.
I loved it, and I'd love to come back and appreciate your show. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Talk to you soon. That was Henry Sobenet from Common Sense Institute. He's a fellow there. You can go and find that study. Fantastic. Common Sense Institute, CO.org. Late for a break. When we come back, we'll jump on. We'll take Don and everyone else's calls at 303-696-1971. This is George Brockler on The George Show. You're listening to 710 KNUS.
The George Show with George Brockler on News Talk 710 KNUS.
We're back on 710 KNUS. Want to get right to the phone lines. Don has been gracious enough to hang on this entire time with that great interview with Henry Sobenet, which you can find on the podcast. Go to that report at commonsenseinstituteco.org. Don, from way down south in Colorado Springs. Sir, you're on The George Show. How are you?
Hey, I like KNUS. That's why I listen to it.
Boom. Thank you.
Just getting back to Michelle Malkins, you're hearing about every election. I mean, I'm afraid you're going to be hearing that more and more as the progressives are getting more and more desperate to fundamentally transform our country. And I mean, and so much of their thinking is close to Saul Alinsky, if anything, in their quest to get power, and they'll do anything to do to get it. And they will lie, cheat, and steal, you know, because they think it's for the greater good. And conservatives are going to have to be more vigilant, and they're going to have to do more than just vote, because voting is becoming more and more of a lost cause on this, especially with the Republican Party that just does not want to be conservative. They're good at giving lip service, but they would rather be kind of a centrist, left-leaning party in which, you know, there's an element of crony capitalism, but they could still have a piece of the social progressive action and take care of the pleasure of the flesh.
You know, it's interesting, too, when you bring up what Republicans are starting to do. We've seen four very popular big-name Republican senators come forward with a plan to give, like, everybody $1,000, you know, for this stimulus thing. And I thought, where in the world
did people's money?
Yeah, where did fiscal conservatism go? But something else that I think we're seeing on the left.
Well, the Bush family kind of flushed that years ago.
Well, there's been that trend, right? I mean, and again, it's very difficult to win an election anymore because of the tribalism, the partisanship, without winning over that undeclared middle, whatever that is. And so I think that's the trend that you see. I think what's interesting about how politics is playing out right now, Don, is that, you know, under Trump, you've got the far left screaming at politicians who are Republicans and on the right saying you're complicit in all the bad things that they characterize that Trump's on. You're complicit if you don't speak out against it. And then all of a sudden we're having riots, full-blown riots in major cities across this country. The deliberate, targeted destruction of public and private property and putting officers' lives at risk, all this stuff. And you don't hear much of anything from the elected leaders from the Democrat Party.
They approve this.
Well, I don't know if they approve it or if they're just scared. But what about that silences complicity stuff that they were trying to heap on Republicans and on the right? Where is that on the left? And so I want to ask you to, in the few seconds we have left, Don, predict November. What's going to happen?
It's going to be a neck-and-neck battle, but if Trump hits on law enforcement pretty hard, he might pull out a win.
I think that's probably about as strong as we could say that. Don, thank you for the call. Thank you for hanging on. We are out of time for this segment. We'll come back for that last hour today on August 1st, Colorado Day 2020, with your calls at 303-696-1971. My name is George Brock. This is The George Show on 710 KNUS.